This is the podcast of the German Historical Institute London, a research centre dedicated to supporting and connecting students and scholars from Britain and Germany. The podcast series presents current research in British, German and European history, as well as colonial and global history. For more information on the German Historical Institute London, future events, the GHIL Library, studentships and more podcast episodes, please visit our website at ghil.ac.uk.
Welcome to our GHIL summer lecture series on historians and the challenge of right-wing populism. Right-wing populist movements around the world make avid use of often simplistic or reductive interpretations of the past to garner support and promote their vision of the future. On television, in newspapers, on websites and social media, the research of professional historians is selectively appropriated, openly challenged, or dismissed entirely as propaganda put forward by an elitist establishment. This lecture series brings together researchers working on topics subject to such reinterpretation who face criticism and at times abuse from right-wing populists. Speakers will reflect on their efforts to prepare and reform their academic disciplines in order to mitigate or preempt appropriations of the past by right-wing populists. They will also consider how to approach contested episodes from the past in university classroom teaching, and how scholars can set the historical record straight by making research-based knowledge of the past accessible and understandable to wider audiences. Today is the first lecture of our GHIL summer lecture series, and it is a roundtable discussion between Corinne Fowler, Susan Naiman, Michael Rothberg, and Mark Tekasidis, chaired by Samira Ahmed, on confronting histories of violence and populism, what can be learned from the Germans, what have the Germans yet to learn? It is organized by the German Historical Institute London in collaboration with the Goethe Institute London. For many countries, the German model of coming to terms with the past has long been considered exemplary with regard to the Holocaust. Many saw that Vergangenheitsbewältigung could serve as a model for other difficult histories. Yet in the recent years, this model's character has come under scrutiny, with the debate around the Humboldt Forum showing that Germany has widely ignored other dark chapters, such as its colonial past. Furthermore, it raised the question of how to place different histories of violence into relation with one another, and whether, as Michael Rothberg puts it, memories of atrocity must stand in a hierarchy. The rise of populism in Germany has led to a resurgence of narratives that were supposed to have been laid to rest, and which seek to avoid difficult chapters entirely and focus on other, more glorious moments of the past instead. So where does this leave us? Can German efforts to atone for Nazi atrocities still serve as a model for how other countries might come to terms with their own legacies? To what extent is the old model of Vergangenheitsbewältigung still relevant in a post-migrant Germany? What other histories need to be written? How can we steer away from competitive models of history writing? And what tools do we have to answer populist or even extremist criticism of contemporary means of dealing with the past? This roundtable brings together four leading experts from Germany, the US, and the UK to discuss these pressing questions of our time. Professor Corinne Fowler directs a public history project called Colonial Countryside, National Trust Houses Reinterpreted. Corinne co-edited the National Trust report on its property's connection to colonialism and historic slavery. She is author of Green Unpleasant Land, Creative Responsive to Rural Britain's Colonial Countryside, published by Peepal Tree Press in 2020. Susan Naiman is the director of the Einstein Forum. Born in Atlanta, Georgia, Naiman studied philosophy at Harvard and the Freie Universität Berlin, and was professor of philosophy at Yale and Tel Aviv University. She is the author of Slow Fire, Jewish Notes from Berlin, The Unity of Reason, Rereading Kant, Evil in Modern Thought, Fremde sehen anders, Moral Clarity, A Guide for Grown-Up Idealists, Why Grow Up, Widerstand der Vernunft, Ein Manifest in Postfaktischen Zeiten, and Learning from the Germans, Race and the Memory of Evil, She is the mother of three grown children and lives in Berlin, Germany. Michael Rothberg is the 1939 Society Samuel Goetz Chair in Holocaust Studies and Professor of English and Comparative Literature at the University of California, Los Angeles. His latest book is The Implicated Subject, Beyond Victims and Perpetrators, published in 2019 by Stanford University Press in their Cultural Memory in the Present series. Previous books include Multidirectional Memory, Remembering the Holocaust in the Age of Decolonization, published in 2009, Dramatic Realism, The Demands of Holocaust Representation, published in 2000 and co-edited with Neil Levy, The Holocaust Theoretical Readings, published in 2003. With Yasemin Yildiz, he is currently completing Inheritance Trouble, Migrant Archives of Holocaust Remembrance for Fordham University Press. Mark Tekasidis is a freelance writer and works on the topics of popular culture, migration, racism, and social change. He studied psychology in Cologne and earned his doctorate in education in Mainz. He was editor of the magazine Specs and presenter for WDR Funkhaus Europa. His book publications include Interkultur, published in 2010, Collaboration, published in 2015 by Edition Surkamp, Nach der Flucht, New Proposals for the Immigration Society, published in 2017 by Reklam, and Wessen Erinnerung zählt, Koloniale Vergangenheit und Rassismus heute, published by Hoffmann und Kampe in 2019. Award-winning journalist and broadcaster Samira Ahmed presents Front Row on Radio 4, Newswatch on BBC One, and the Intelligence Square podcast, How I Found My Voice. She won the British Broadcasting Press Guild Audio Presenter of the Year Award in 2020. Samira's acclaimed BBC Four series, Art of Persia, was the first major documentary series to be filmed in Iran for 40 years. Samira won the Stonewall Broadcast of the Year Award while a presenter at Channel 4 News. She has been a BBC News correspondent, a reporter on Newsnight, a news anchor for World Service TV and Deutsche Welle TV. We hope you enjoy this roundtable discussion.
Welcome to everybody, and welcome to the Goethe Institute London Online and a discussion on confronting histories of violence and populism. Who knew that historians and our museums and our heritage institutions would find themselves in the front line of a culture war? A definition is needed, though I know all our panelists tonight would say there are many different ways of defining populism in different contexts, but I've tried to give us a couple. The Cambridge Dictionary defines populism as political ideas and activities that are intended to get the support of ordinary people by giving them what they want. The British historian Michael Burley, in his very recent book, Populism Before and Since the Pandemic, which is terrific, by the way, has defined populism as the identification of the people as an organic and uniquely virtuous whole, ignored or malignly divided by corrupt and oligarchic elites. I think the idea of ordinary people and elites is absolutely one that is central to thinking about populism. I'm going to give a brief summary of what I think the background is to this debate before introducing our panel. What we've seen in both Germany and the UK, and in many other nations, notably the US, is the rise of political movements focused on new ideas of patriotism and concerns about issues such as immigration or EU membership. Some, like UKIP, were mainstream. Others, such as Alternativ für Deutschland, and especially Pegida and the English Defence League, are more controversial. Out of this has emerged political tension over contested history, to some extent given a new impetus by the global Black Lives Matter protests sparked after the murder of George Floyd. How we view issues such as our nation's role in slavery, in colonialism, and their legacy in the modern day, this is all very much being debated right now. In Germany, just a few days ago, the foreign ministry confirmed that the country would be returning all its Benin bronzes to Nigeria. They'd been looted, of course, at the end of the 19th century by British troops. But other issues have emerged over development, for example, of the Humboldt Forum in Berlin. The alleged erasure of East Germany is a particularly interesting part of Germany's story and how it's dealt with history, not just the Holocaust, but more recently. In the UK, government ministers have in recent months called for museums and cultural institutions to present positive history, accusing town hall militants and woke worthies of pulling down statues. In fact, only one statue, of course, has actually been pulled down and people have been charged with criminal damage. And ministers accused these woke worthies of an attempt to impose a single, often negative narrative of Britain's history. And yet, only a few weeks ago, the government publicly apologised in the UK for how, as the result of a historical investigation, it emerged the governments of the past had treated the graves and failed to memorialise Black and Asian soldiers who died fighting for Britain in the First World War. Now, an idea to throw at you before we begin. There's long been an idea thrown around that Germany somehow established a clear and mostly honest reckoning with its Nazi past. Britain, by contrast, it's been said, has tended to present a positive story about wartime victory and a peaceful transition from empire to a happy Commonwealth. I think it's fair to say that neither version is quite right. In fact, 23 years ago, I remember my editor at Deutsche Welle TV telling me that the Germans didn't have a problem with empire, unlike you Brits. So that's the background to this conversation with four very eminent thinkers and historians. We have just under an hour for the discussion. If you want to start submitting questions, can I recommend you use the Q&A, not the general chat, but use the general chat just to be able to share thoughts and as we're going through. And I'll try and pick out some of the questions and put them to our panellists. So let me introduce them. Professor Corin Fowler is director of the history and writing project called Colonial Countryside, National Trust Houses Reinterpreted, and also co-edited the National Trust report on its houses' connection to the British Empire. You may have noticed her mentioned in some news headlines in recent months, and I know she'll talk about that. Philosopher Susan Nyman, Professor Susan Nyman, is director of the Einstein Forum and the author of Learning from the Germans. She was born in Atlanta, Georgia, but has lived and worked in Berlin for many years. So a really interesting view on the American and the German experience in particular. Professor Michael Rothberg is a professor of English and comparative literature and chair of Holocaust studies at UCLA and joins us from LA. Welcome to you. And Dr. Mark Turkasidis is a writer, author of a book, most recent book about contested memory and German colonialism. Welcome to you all. Absolutely thrilled to have such a panel. And I'm conscious that for those of you out there joining us from all over the world, hopefully, there may be those of you who have a very strong knowledge of German history, those of you who may not so much. I'm not going to attempt in this hour to go into detail about everything, but I wanted to ask each of my guests, from your point of view, working in issues around history, around memorialization, and very aware of the changing political debates around them, how does it look to you in terms of what are the biggest stories right now that are coming up in your field of work? And how concerned at all are you in terms of the role of populism and politicians in maybe creating tension there? Who wants to go first? Corin, why don't you go for it?
Okay, well, I mean, you mentioned the toppling of Colston's statue, and you rightly said, of course, there's only one statue being toppled, because you would imagine from the government response that we're having statues pulled down all over the country. But I think that many historians have said there's never been such an amazing moment for public history where people really, really care about how our colonial past is represented.
Michael, can I ask you next? Because it felt that in America, in many ways, kicked off this international sense of thinking, and that what was happening to civil rights statues, for example, has been really interesting to watch over the last couple of years.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's certainly an exciting moment, and there's a lot going on, and I think there's a lot that's contradictory going on. I mean, I think we have, as you mentioned in your introduction, Samira, the recent decision by Germany to send back the Binion bronzes. There's a really big and important shift going on, I think, in how various countries are dealing with colonial heritage, how various societies are confronting structural racism and white supremacy. And so there, on the one hand, very positive developments going on. On the other hand, and you've looked at from the United States, we have, you know, a continuation of police violence. The very day that The murderer of George Floyd was convicted. We had another murder of a teenage girl, right, by the police. So it's what I see is very contradictory developments. On the one hand, greater visibility for some of these, for the legacies of racism and colonialism. On the other hand, it's very clear that the problems are persistent and are still very much with us. So will we be able to go beyond symbolically addressing these histories and really get at some of the structural continuities that continue to exist is, I think, for me, a key question.
Who wants to go next? Mark, would you like to go next?
Yeah, I mean, I just want to back the point Michael already mentioned that the developments are quite contradictory right now. So if it concerns Germany, you have on the one side a broadening discussion about racism, not only with Black Lives Matters, but or the big rallies after Black Lives Matters, but with an undertow before that it was possible to address racism in the Federal Republic directly. And you have a broadening discussion about the German past, which concerns colonialism. And one can actually say that Germany has learned something from the working of the past, Vergangenheitsbewältigung in a way, because the establishment of colonialism as a pillar of memorization in Germany went quite fast. And then the discussion about restitution took a very went very fast too when the conference of the cultural minister decided that restitution is possible in the Federal Republic. That is the one side. The other side is that we have a rising tide of populism, but I'm not actually very much afraid of that. I mean, if you see, if you have a look at the politics in the Federal Republic, one can say that the Christian Democratic Union always integrated the right fringe in Germany by actually saying something racist. It's easy as that. In those days, the minister president of Bavaria, Edmund Stoiber, actually said that the double citizenship will bring a greater security risk to Germany than the Red Army fraction. So that is what the minister president of Bavaria actually said, to integrate the right fringe. And that is not longer the case with Angela Merkel. She has given up on that kind of policy. And so these right-wing fringe became a party, actually, the so-called Alternative for Germany, AfD. But if you look at the situation that Germany had the biggest so-called refugee crisis in its history in 2015, and if you look that there was an Islamist attack in the very center of Berlin, and so on and so on, then I mean 10-15% voters for Alternative for Germany, that is not something I am really afraid of. They are more visible than before. But I don't know if that is something I should be afraid of, or something I should be in a way. I think it is a good thing because it is not longer Staatsraison.
You've brought up so many great ideas, and I'm going to bring in Susan now. And the one thing that Mark mentioned, which might need a little more explanation, is this concept of Vergangenheitsbewältigung, working off the past. And Mark said that because of Germany's experience with having had to do so much reckoning with dealing with its Nazi past, that actually when it came to starting to talk about things like the Benin Bronzes, in a way they've moved relatively fast. I think that's a good summary of that point. But Susan, what would you like to observe on what you've noticed?
Sure, well, lots of things. First of all, by the way, for German speakers, I don't use the term Vergangenheitsbewältigung. That's an older term. It means conquering the past. And it rather suggests that you can do something with your shameful past history and be done with it. I use the term Vergangenheitsaufarbeitung, which means
Working
through the past. Well, Mark used Bewältigung. I mean, lots of people do. It's not an attack on Mark. It's like lots of people use the word Jim Crow in America, which I think is a terrible euphemism. But we're not talking about America tonight. But Look, I am one of the people who has strongly argued for the thesis that you mentioned in the beginning, that Germany has done a better job in dealing with its national crimes than any other country in the world. That doesn't mean that it's done a good job. That doesn't mean that it's over. But it does mean that unlike any, well, here's the first really important thing, I think, for non-Germans to know, that it's a dirty little secret that you have to work fairly hard to get at, which is that for about the first 40 years after the war, West Germans saw themselves as victims, not as perpetrators. In fact, they saw themselves as the worst victims of the war. And when I was working on my book, Learning from the Germans, I realized this is actually a very natural process, that people would like to see their people as heroes. They, if they can't do that, they see themselves as victims. Germany is the first country ever to make the further step and say, yes, we suffered, but other people suffered more and it was our fault. And that's a major step, even though they didn't do it willingly. I mean, that has to be emphasized. They didn't do it willingly. They didn't do it quickly. And this is another point, if we have a chance to talk about reunification, West Germany did a worse job of it than East Germany, which is not very well known. So I think Mark is absolutely right that given that they had a certain amount of practice in facing national shame in a way that other countries are simply not used to, there was a space, there was a field of discussion so that when people, particularly people of color in Germany, began to say, look, it's not just what you did to the Jews, even if German colonial history was later and they got into the colonial game, if you want to call it that, too late to have as many colonies as Britain or France, there's still a significant colonial history that we haven't dealt with. And that has been discussed. It was discussed before Black Lives Matter. I was really pleased to see, since I've argued in other contexts, that the US has things to learn from the Germans, that the Black Lives Matter demonstrations really ramped up the discussion of colonialism. And it's a major topic, that has to be faced. And the German government has realized that. And the Benin Bronzes is only one sign of that. But I happen to have a meeting with the director of the Humboldt Forum and some of his staff this morning for a project that we're working on together. And, you know, it's all they care about, basically, is trying to come up with an adequate response to the fact that they, well, I can tell the story of the Humboldt Forum maybe later. Maybe I'll just stop there if people are interested. You're muted.
I'll come back to that quite soon. I wanted to ask Corinne, could you just briefly tell us about your experience with your National Trust research? Because the British experience has been, it's relatively recent that historians in television documentaries and in books and within institutions have started to look at what's the slavery connection behind a lot of these places. And it's prompted a discussion, particularly in Britain, focused on slavery. You know, and can you tell us what was your research? What was the hostility you met and what's where things are now?
Yes, so I worked with the National Trust on a report which highlights that about a third of their properties that we know about have connections to empire, either the East India Company or to slavery. And that report was released in September 2020. And then I had what you might call the opposite of the ivory tower experience of an academic, because all hell broke loose. And there were government ministers making speeches in Parliament and saying that because Churchill was included on the report, that we were denigrating the memory of Churchill and so on. There were two parliamentary debates about the future of the National Trust and the National Trust report. And then the newspapers really kind of piled in on this whole discussion. And in about 6 months, there have been about 150 really hostile newspaper articles. Well, first of all, about the National Trust. for sort of daring to produce such a report in the first place. Then they attacked increasingly myself as an academic and the colonial countryside historians. So they said we were politically motivated. They said we were unpatriotic. And there was no right of reply to these newspaper articles. So even though they were reporting very inaccurately, obviously people were then infuriated when they read the articles, and that sent a whole load of threats and hate mail in our direction. So we've been at the sharp end of populism and also extremism, I would say. So I would characterize, just in summary, it was a really concerted attempt at quite a high level to intimidate us, to silence us, to present us as enemies, as unpatriotic, and so on. And I think that it was really quite hard to stand our ground and insist on talking about the facts and the right to speak about evidence-based research. So it was very difficult. And I think that women academics are particular targets of this, and people of colour still worse.
Thank you for that summary. And I should say, for those who don't know, the National Trust is a charity that sort of, it was gifted a lot of stately homes, particularly after the Second World War, when aristocratic families couldn't afford to keep them. So it has, I think, is it 2 million members? It's one of the largest membership organisations. And the profile is...
5.6 million.
How many?
5.6 million.
5.6 million. And so typically people buy membership and they go and visit these homes, and you have a day out and you can have a cream tea in the cafe and you can walk around the grounds. And the mention of Churchill is that his home, is it Chartwell, which he was gifted by the nation, in Corinne's research, they found there was connections to the original construction and ownership of the house that went back to slavery, and somehow this was deemed to be disrespectful. So what Corinne's done has given a sense of how in Britain, certainly in the last year or so in particular, there's been definite attempts to create real anger around the idea of questioning the pasts of some of these institutions, where of course all it is adding stuff we didn't know. So I don't know how far that's unique. Michael, in the States, I've got a sense that it's very much done on a political platform. The news media don't seem to be getting involved in the same way in stirring up this culture war. Do you think they are? Oh, sorry, you're muted.
Yeah, sorry. Yeah, I don't know that we've had this quite the same kind of dynamic that Corinne just described, though I recognize it a little bit from Germany, where in a much smaller way, I've found that my own ideas have been very much distorted in the kind of press journalistic responses that I've seen there. People who are not actually reading the books that they're responding to, who are accusing you of things that you've never done. And I know Susan has had a lot of exciting issues similar to this. So there is, in some ways, very hostile kind of response going on. In the US, I don't think we have quite the same thing. No, I think it's more mobilized from a kind of grassroots political level, and also to a certain extent, party political level.
Susan, could I get you? You gave us so many tantalizing hints at where we could go. You said specifically that you thought East Germany had done a better job of unification than West Germany.
No, not a better job of unification, a better job of facing Nazi crimes.
Ah, right. Sorry, I misheard then. Could we talk about East Germany? Because I'd like to discuss both elements, and obviously all the panelists are welcome. When I was working in Berlin, it was it was 8 years after unification. And you had this real sense of, you know, nostalgia, you know, this sense with some East Germans that their past was being ignored or obliterated. And given that that's only 40 years ago, it adds an extra layer to our discussion, doesn't it, about how Germany has dealt with its history. So what are your observations about East Germany's experience after the war, and then more recently, how a united Germany has dealt with its own history?
Well, first of all, Ostalgie, which is playing on nostalgie, is a snarky term invented by the West to, put down any, any East German missing various features of East Germany. And there's all kinds of very interesting research that the longer we go from reunification, which is 30 years ago, the more East Germans, former East Germans, regret that they didn't fight harder to keep features of their system. But that's a separate issue from the one that interests me the most. I'm trying to figure out how to say this really quickly. So there's a myth among a number of professional historians and people who work in memory studies in Germany that working off the past really didn't begin until reunification. And this is not only false, it really is an affront to the efforts, first of all, in the West, of thousands and thousands of grassroots activists, from churches to artists to intellectuals, who pushed very hard against the prevailing complete lack of desire in West Germany to talk about the Nazis at all. They really wanted to close the books. And it was, you know, the concerted efforts of many people in the West who forced a change towards the end of the 80s before reunification. But secondly, it's an affront, an attempt to wipe out what the East Germans did and to create a very different narrative. And the narrative that you get today is a West German narrative, which is that what the Nazis did wrong was that they put Jews in concentration camps and murdered them. The story in the East was quite different. It did not prioritize victims of the Holocaust. It also talked about the 14 million Slavic civilians who were killed in the colonial drive to take over the East. It talked about racism as a general term of which anti-Semitism was a part. This is a view that I happen to hold. It's now extremely controversial. Michael has been ripped up in major German newspapers, as have I, for saying.
It's interesting.
And you know what we forget, what the East Germans very clearly knew, is that the first victims of the Nazis were communists. We all know this very famous statement of the pastor Martin Niemöller. First they came for the communists and nobody was there, and then they came for the social democrats. But the truth is,
I'm conscious of time as well, Susan. Right. Sorry, so because I want to bring in Mark. But did you want to make your other point as well?
Well, let me just say that this is not to say that East Germany did everything perfectly either. They also instrumentalized their anti-fascism. But the one message that the Nazis were criminals and defeating them was a good thing was a message that you could hear on one side of Germany and not on the other. And I really believe that in erasing that, it's made it harder to confront other forms of racism and confront the colonial past because it's been very, very focused on crimes against Jews.
Interesting. Mark.
I mean, I just want to add something to what Susan said. The most interesting thing about the Vergangenheitsbewältigung, I don't think that it is actually conquering of the past, but Bewältigung means something like negotiation, the most interesting aspect of that is the process in which civil society protested dealing with the past in the official language. So, I mean, it was the Allied forces who put Germany in a position to reflect upon its past. But after that, it was the civil society. After that, it was the students who said, did you forget about Nazism? My parents, what did they do in the Nazi times? And the Nazis were actually there. I mean, I recollect that I went to rallies in the early 80s with the peace movement, and there were these old guys standing at the side of the streets, and they were looking at us and telling us, okay, they forgot to put you in the gas chamber. So that was in the early 80s, when you dared to go to a demonstration, which was not in accordance to their idea of society. So they were still there. So the civil society actually did the Vergangenheitsbewältigung. They protested, the students protested, the alternative scene protested. It was the history workshops on a local level, which actually found out about who was incriminated by Nazism and so on. And if you look at the universities, the process of thinking about all that came very late. So 80% of the historians in Germany, they were actually incriminated. 40% of them were champions of National Socialism, and they were in their positions after Second World War. And when did they start the discussion? In 1998, they talked for the first time at the annual meeting of the historians about their profession and National Socialism. So it was a process. It was a whole process. And now this process of civil society talking about the past is one which is actually renewed by this discussion about colonialism. And that is the thing I found interesting about Germany. One thing, I don't know who said that, but there was this discussion about the Holocaust Memorial in the very center of Berlin. One observer said that I found very nice. It is the most interesting thing about the Holocaust Memorial is this kind of discussion about the Holocaust Memorial and about every little aspect of the Holocaust Memorial, and this discussion is the thing which is very important for a society. I think the struggle is very important for a society.
Michael.
Yeah, I just wanted to come in and add to that. I think those are really important points, and I'm very much on the same page with Susan and Mark on, I think, a lot of these questions. I think something did shift, though, after unification, which was that grassroots energy that Mark was just referring to and that Susan also referred to, became kind of monumentalized and incorporated into the state. Yeah. And I think something really significant happened starting at that moment. And I think that there's been a kind of freezing, a kind of reification, we'd say in a slightly academic way, of this Holocaust memory. And even though I agree so much with Susan that this is an achievement that really no other country can point to in terms of confronting its own past, certain problems have started to emerge in the last 20 years. A certain fixed notion of German identity, which is in very, very much still an ethnic notion of German identity, which I think is very strong. A certain fixed notion of Jews as victims, as the ones who died in the Holocaust, and therefore are very difficult. I think that this contemporary German society has difficulty perceiving the diversity of actual living Jews, the political as well as cultural and religious diversity. And so with this kind of monumentalized Holocaust memory has come simplified understandings of perpetrators and victims. And I think that's starting to have dangerous effects in the way we talk about various forms of racism that still exist today. Even as I do think, I agree that there has been a kind of stimulation of the discussion of colonialism that has also come out of that memory of the Holocaust. And I think that's also very important.
I want to stay on this issue, Michael, about how in a much multicultural set of societies, things like the Holocaust and dealing with colonialism are being dealt with. Could you just add a line or two? You said that there was something very disturbing that had been emerging in the last 20 years.
Yeah, I think for a long time, people with a migrant background, as it's said in Germany, racialized immigrants in Germany were considered completely outside of this story, right? The story of the Holocaust of Germans and Jews had nothing to do with them. At a certain point, it started to become a necessary component of being German, right? So in order to be German, you had to remember the Holocaust. And migrants and racialized minorities started to be brought into that conversation. But at the same time as they were being required to remember the Holocaust, they were also being told, this is not your history, right? And pushed away. And so it creates this kind of double bind, I think, for people in minoritized positions within Germany. And that's what I mean when I think it kind of reconfirms a certain ethnic German identity. We are the ones who are responsible. We are the ones who need to remember. The rest of you, this is not really your history. You can't really be German because you did not participate in this, or your ancestors did not participate in this.
I got the sense that was changing now, Mark, that I'd seen research, in fact, the Goethe Institute sent me, of interviews with young migrants who very much, have you know, engaged with the story of the Nazi past. I don't know, what's your view on this? Because Michael's kind of hinting at this concept of kind of contested histories or competing histories.
Just to be clear, I'm not saying that migrants haven't or don't engage with the history. I think they do. I'm saying there's a problem with the recognition of that.
Sure. Again. Sorry, no, important to clarify that. Thank you, Michael. Who wants to respond? Mark, sorry, go ahead. And then Corinne.
Well, it's hard to speak for the population with a migrant background in the Federal Republic. So, I mean, they're very different. They come from different origins. They are very different in their ideas of the past and so on. I mean, basically, it is taught in school. It is talked about in school. It is discussed in school. And I think Michael is absolutely right about this double bind. But more and more, the diversity of the classes has become quite normal. And so this kind of discussion is in a way one that affects all of the pupils, because the pupils of German origin, they don't have any direct connection with the Holocaust anymore. They are young, they don't have any. So the only connection is about the privileges of Germany as a violent state with a violent history, with an imperialist history, with a history of exploitation and so on. And this is shared by people of all origins living in Germany. Second point is that, if we broaden the picture and take into consideration the diversity of the pupils in Germany, let's stay with the pupils, then there are a lot of other conflicts worth discussing. So isn't it worth discussing if you have a big population of Turkish origin, isn't it worth discussing the genocide of the Armenians and so on? So there is the whole picture of history has to become multi-perspective to get a different picture of the diversity of the origins of the pupils.
Thank you. I should say, in passing on to Corinne, that of course President Biden has recognized the Armenian genocide. It's so interesting how these moments
also Germany,
can be. So yes, but I think for the US, I mean, I don't think the British government has yet. It's really interesting how these moments really matter. Corinne, your thoughts, and then Susan.
Yes, so I was just going to add that, you know, why so much of the discussion about British colonialism is so close to the bone is that the legacy of colonialism is not just about the built heritage your country has, is your infrastructure, your railways and your ports and all that. It's also to do with the way we think. And it's also to do with the way that we represent the past. You know, whose story do we include in our version of Britain's past? And there is, of course, because of this, a connection, a sort of umbilical connection between colonialism and the racist ways of thinking. And I think many, many thinkers and historians have sort of brought that out. But I think when it comes to education, it's interesting to think about what's happening in German schools, because I know that I'm not the only one who went through the whole British education system until university without ever once learning about what the empire was. Which seems incredible, doesn't it? Considering that it represents 400 years of our most formative history. But also without a long view on immigration, believing the Windrush myth, even the idea that the Windrush, the arrival of the Empire Windrush was the inaugural moment of Black Britishness. I didn't know anything about, you know, African Romans, African Tudors, Indian princes who visited Britain, Indian sailors, Lascars, Black gardeners, Black servants, Black abolitionists, and as Samir has mentioned earlier, Commonwealth soldiers who fought as part of World War I, World War II, the one bit of history we do go over and over again, even though that is a relatively short period in history compared to the four centuries of colonial activity.
Susan, what are your thoughts? We're focused particularly on the impact of multicultural modern identity and this debate around history and populism.
Look, what Corinne said, I don't live in Britain, but I do regularly follow a lot of the discussion, and it, you know, everything that I've followed, you know, just confirms your own experience. You're not only not the only person. The Guardian did a poll a year ago, and only 19% of British citizens said they saw anything to be ashamed of or apologize for in the history of empire, which is pretty incredible, okay? You know, and I indeed, when I first began working on my book, Learning from the Germans, I had originally thought it was going to be divided into three parts, and I was going to talk about remembering the past in Germany, in the US, and in Britain, and then it just got too long, and my editor was impatient, and so I left out the British part. But the interesting thing was, when I told very, very educated person that I wanted to talk about European colonialism, and I was thinking of taking on the subject of England and Ireland, which I know quite a bit about. And she looked at me and she said, "That's European imperialism." Not even want to put, British colonialism in the, chapter of, as a chapter in the history of European colonialism. That's 5 years ago. So obviously you've had an enormous movement in the last year in Britain. And, as to how this works in a multi-colonial society, look, one of the discussions that we have in, one of the questions that comes up in the debates surrounding reparations for African-American slavery that comes up in the States is, my family came to the country after the Civil War. They didn't own any slaves. I'm not responsible for anything. Well, guess what? Almost all white people came to the United States after the Civil War, when all of these waves of immigration started. And nevertheless, it seems to me that if you sign on to become a citizen and you enjoy certain privileges of citizenship wherever you are, you also take over certain responsibilities. Exactly what those responsibilities are is a question for negotiation, and should be decided locally, it seems to me. But I don't buy the idea that your ancestors had to, fight at the Battle of Hastings or come over on the Mayflower or whatever it was, in order to have a responsibility towards the country that you're a citizen of. Mm.
There are some really good questions in the chat, so I'm going to go to these now. Right. This is someone called Alice Dare Campbell. If there is a worrying development with institutions like Goethe Institute and the British Council in that they could be accused of soft colonial power. Alasdair says he works with both organisations in the arts across culture, and there is more and more interference from government about what these institutions' focus should be. In the UK, British Council are more and more being involved with the trade developments that Brexit has removed. So money's being focused on countries that the UK government needs to develop trade with, in his view. He thinks it's complicated but worrying. From all your different perspectives, do you think there is an issue with, cultural institutions being leaned on by governments to sort of do a trade-focused remit?
So I can only speak for Germany and not for the British Council. The Goethe Institute is funded by the Foreign Office, but to call it soft colonialism is I think, at least in the case of the Goethe Institute, really a problem and a sort of knee-jerk response to contemporary, wanting to be more, more Catholic than the Pope, except in a different sense. The Goethe Institute really spends a lot of time thinking very carefully about what kinds of programs it wants to subsidize, what kinds of message it wants to broadcast to the rest of the world, how to work with oppositional members of government. So I've got to say, full disclosure, I'm a member of the board of advisors of the Goethe Institute, but that means I do go to meetings and I hear a lot about what goes on behind the scenes. And I think they're very careful. In fact, no one, Germans, try and get a German to say they ought to export their country's culture, and you'll have a very hard time finding anyone. On the contrary, it's considered bad taste to even say anything very, very laudatory about German culture. So I don't see a problem there, but Corinne may see a very different problem.
That has something to do with the fact that these institutions were historically intertwined with soft colonialism. That was actually one of their duties in this kind of soft imperialism of Germany, for example, in Southeastern Europe or in the Ottoman Empire, to make moral conquests. To bring German culture to other countries, to in a way support the economic penetration by the German economic powers. And maybe this is part of Vergangenheit's Bewältigung or Aufarbeitung too, that now the institution like the Goethe Institute is quite, especially on a local level, is quite autonomous. And that is actually a good thing.
Susan, I want to just move on to another question because I'm conscious of the last 10 minutes, but I think you might be able to add on what you wanted to say in response to this. Tony Walker, I thought I'd saved this question, but I hadn't. I wonder if participants have any ideas on how to break out of the culture wars with academics and activists on the one side, it seems, versus ordinary folk, I think this is all in quotation marks, who will be stirred up by the mass media coverage. Is there any mileage in, for example, getting figures with brand recognition and indeed conservative profiles, whether they're actors or musicians or whatever, who could act as sort of messengers and perhaps sort of soften the row? I think it's quite an interesting idea. Is that, what's the strategy for tackling it? Corinne, go first.
Yeah, I've thought a lot about this because I've really had to. And I think that there are so many things that we can do. I mean, first of all, not patronizing people, because it takes years to come to the point where we know a lot about British colonial history, and our education system has not equipped people for accepting a lot of this information. So I think there's a degree of understanding and respect that's required. But at the same time, it's important to maintain the principle of having the respect to include the history of everyone in our accounts of the British past. But I do think that there are certain phenomena that can be addressed through genuine engagement with, for example, this idea that either you speak about working class oppression in the factories and so on, or you talk about colonial history. And this either or-ism is really unhelpful. But actually, because the history of things like rural poverty, enclosure, the production of copper and so on is so intertwined with the history of empire, you can do both. So I think that that's one way forward, which is potentially really good. I think the other way is to understand what's at stake for people in shifting their worldview. It takes an enormous amount of effort. So I think some compassion and less judgment, and also a sort of calm and respectful involvement with people to sort of produce more knowledge, and to persuade people that more knowledge is actually better than less knowledge, and that by contributing to our collective understanding of the past. We're not taking something away, we are also adding it. But I think it's important to recognize that civic pride is important to people, and that we do also need inspirational stories, even if it's about Haitians who resisted the French army and the British army, or women who struggled against suffrage, or people who helped end child labor in the past and so on. But at the same time, balance this with a clear line, because I think you cannot be timid in this environment. You have to unequivocally and clearly state that you can't take a neutral position on racism, you can't take a neutral position on Britain's position, colonial history. You can't just ignore it because it's so formative. So I think you have to make the case, but do it respectfully and do that across generations, across political divides, and also across cultures.
Michael, I'll come to you next on this, and then Susan, sorry.
Yeah, I mean, I really like what Corinne just said, and I agree with a lot of it. What she described as this either or perspective is what I call in my work the logic of the zero sum game, right? That if we're remembering the Holocaust, that means we can't be remembering slavery or colonialism. And my own work has been about uncovering, and I think this speaks to the inspiration idea too, kind of unexpected solidarities across histories, and trying to open up people to more complex and nuanced understandings of the past and of the present, and the way that these different histories in fact intersect with each other and create kind of dynamics in which we get more understanding, more memory, more histories brought into the picture, what I call multidirectionality, instead of being locked into these fixed identity positions, into this either or zero sum logic. But it's obviously a complicated thing to do in the public sphere, but I think this is one of the things we need to keep on trying to improve our ability to speak in clear and nuanced ways about these issues.
Susan.
I actually don't think it's quite as complicated as Michael suggests. I liked very much what Corinne said. She used the word inspiration. I used the word heroes. People really do need heroes. That is, what we're seeking is a nuanced understanding of our nation's histories. And I think so, as we're considering which statues or which memorials to take down, I think it's at least as important to think, about who we're going to remember, which people had lives which embodied the values that we want our communities to share. And just to, say one thing to what Mark said before about soft colonialism, one, we don't have time to go into all the details, but the simple fact that a country is proud of aspects of its culture and would like to showcase them doesn't strike me as colonialism at all. It strikes me as, there's a wonderful line from, but I won't be able to quote it exactly. There's no reason not to be proud of cultural achievements, also of moments in which, and they exist in every nation, in which people have stood up in solidarity for justice with other people. So I get a little nervous when academics begin to go into overdrive. When I first, let's just say I think that's alienating. I completely agree with Corinne that we have to tell the truth, and that the truths have not been told. But there's another side to these histories that also need to be uncovered, and there's nothing wrong with lifting them up.
Mark.
Yeah, well, okay, it's hard to discuss that in detail now. I don't think I'm going into overdrive when I accuse the German cultural institution of the past, especially in Imperial Germany of being involved in soft imperialism. I'm not the only one doing that in historical terms. But let's skip that because I wanted to go to this question, what's about to do. I think that media play a decisive role because they are actually very, very polarizing. So I'm sorry, Samira, but mass media actually really, they fuel conflicts. They want the polarization. They want the emotions of the polarization. And that is, that has become quite a problem. That's a traditional media, social media. Okay, the polarization comes very fast also. And yet, especially now during the academic, one could really feel that. This that you live in a world where there's always polarization, media polarization. And I think we have to like meet in flesh. So for example, the museums, and that is quite a discussion which is going over this point of restitution. For example, these museums could become spaces of negotiation about the past. They could become spaces of deliberation. They could become spaces where we discuss national heritage. And if we do it in the flesh, and we have a process in many, many museums in a country, then this polarization won't happen that fast as it happens in media. So that's just an example that I think this has to be a process in flesh and with a moderation.
I've been given permission to go a few minutes over because our audience are obviously still very much engaged. I want to end by bringing up an issue which Susan raised as a sort of a specific example that we could talk around. And it was the Humboldt Forum, the development in Berlin, and what it says about the state of issues around populism and contested history. I know in Britain, you know, it's very, very controversial, the idea of returning objects. And there has been specific criticism by politicians of museums and of certain museums and certain museum academics supposedly bringing a woke agenda. So there's a deliberate fueling of a row about what museums are for and the stories being told. So can I ask all of you, obviously those of you with the German focus, to talk about the Humboldt Forum and what would be useful in the context of this discussion to know about your views on what's going on there? Susan, do you want to go first?
Well, the Humboldt Forum has a really interesting and I find deeply ironic history. That is, there was an imperial palace in the middle of Berlin, the most central place in Berlin. It was partially bombed during the war. The East German government blew it up in 1953 because they did not want to have vestiges of colonialism and imperialism, and they built instead something called the Palace of the Republic, which was a multi-purpose building that both housed the not terribly effective East German parliament, but was also a place of great cultural coming together, performances, and people celebrated their birthdays there. When, after reunification, there was a strong push to blow up the Palace of the Republic, and instead to reconstruct the original palace. And it was clearly a rather reactionary thing to do. Of course, many former East Germans were very unhappy about it. But one question kept coming into the discussion, it was a long discussion, why in the world do we need this building? Why should we build a huge building on this space? And the people interested in doing it came up with what seemed at the time in the late 90s and early aughts as a progressive thing. They said, oh, here's what we'll do. We'll take our non-European art collections, which are way out on the edge of the city, and we'll put them right in the middle in conversation with the European art collections to uplift, you know, non-European art. And then only really quite recently did people start thinking about the fact, gosh, all of the stuff or nearly all of the stuff was looted. So I find this world historically funny that this can change so quickly from thinking this was a progressive thing to do to thinking this is a disaster. And some people think it's such a disaster that there are a group of people who have sworn never to set foot in the Humboldt Forum. But the Humboldt Forum is actually trying to do just the sort of thing that Mark is suggesting museums do. They very much want to be a space in which histories are debated and contested. And I have to say that the director of the museum has taken some quite controversial political stance. He's gone out on several limbs supporting this Weltoffenheit movement and other things. So I'm actually cautiously optimistic that they'll manage to, and you know, giving back. Yeah. Very true. I'm cautiously optimistic that they're going in the right direction.
Can I just say that is such a brilliant summary of a really bizarre situation. So thank you so much, Susan. Any other thoughts either on that or reflecting on your own national examples of the museum as this sort of strange forum for it all? Yes, Michael.
Just one thought that's occurred to me recently about the Benin bronzes and all the discussions about those is that, right, so here are these... incredibly valuable sacred works that have been looted by the British, and yet they're globally dispersed. And it's that global dispersion which really strikes me. So they're in Germany, they're in the US, they're at UCLA, in fact, right out on my very campus. And that, for me, that's a real indication of how we are all implicated in a kind of global colonial system or imperial system, whether or not we are directly responsible or guilty for the actual looting. We are beneficiaries of that looting in a certain sense, and therefore we are implicated in that history. And so it seems to me the Benin bronzes are a really good way of getting at this kind of dispersed form of historical responsibility that so many of us have for the histories of imperialism that continue to echo in the present.
Brilliant observation. Of course, it all comes back to trade, doesn't it? Corinne, and then final word to Mark.
Yeah, I just wanted to just add that I think it is a worrying time for museums in particular in the heritage sector, because the arm's length principle, the idea that a government shouldn't interfere directly, is being violated and pushed out and threatened. And the Museum Studies Association has done exactly what it should have done, which is to make a collective stand with all museum professionals standing together. And I think that this is the only way to push back and say, look, this is not okay. I do think, though, that upholding nostalgic views of history is very dangerous, because what is happening is that people are being united against a perceived common enemy, and you create these hate figures. I mean, as I've mentioned, I'm just one of many, many, many people who've been at the sharp end of that. And these thin-skinned attitudes to history are very easily manipulated for political gain. So I do think we have to be vigilant, and I think we can't afford to be complacent at all. And I, as an academic, am very committed to stepping into that arena, as I think many other academics are, and to support in whatever way we can through the production of knowledge and the assessment of knowledge and the focus on evidence-based research to assist in that conversation nationally.
Thank you, Corinne. I should say members of the audience as well have been saying to pass on their, you know, their shock and their sympathy for what you've had to go through. So thank you. Mark.
You know, I was just thinking about this kind of intriguing thought of Michael, that the dispersed character of the Benin bronzes show this kind of implicated character of the West in general. I'm doing a piece right now on the Prussian expedition to East Asia in the 19th century, very early expedition to Japan, China, and Thailand. And the most interesting thing about that was that you can see how these Western nations were actually had a great deal of solidarity in their in their drive to imperialism. So they were backing each other when it came to contracts and so on. So, and that is a very interesting project to take the Benin bronzes to show this kind of this kind of world of solidarity in imperialism as historical fact. So it's a good thing to cooperate internationally in this.
Do you know one lovely thing that came out of the whole story of the Benin bronzes is that Aberdeen University said they were giving back one, which they'd only acquired, I think, relatively recently, you know, sort of in the 1960s or something. But I think the Church of England also said they were going to give back two. And then it turned out they weren't real Benin bronzes. They were like replicas they'd been given as a gift. But they were going to give them back if Nigeria wanted them, which I thought was quite sweet. What can I say? What a panel. And I know there's been so much really thoughtful comment as well as questions submitted in the Q&A. In the time we've had and with the kind of depth of answers that we've been privileged to get, I think you can understand why we didn't necessarily run through every question. But I think we covered all the kind of key issues that I was really hoping we would get round to. It's an exciting time. It's potentially an optimistic time as well as potentially a very difficult time. I hesitate to say dangerous, but I think as Corinne in particular has said, it's a time to be vigilant as well and to watch what's happening and to think about why it's happening too. But I've been thrilled that the Goethe Institute has decided to organise this event. Thank you so much, the Goethe Institute, to all my brilliant panellists and to all the audience. And I hope that we'll be able to meet again and discuss new things and hopefully meet in person one day. Although we wouldn't have had, you know, we had Los Angeles, we had Berlin, we had the UK, we had everything on this call. So that's quite something. Thank you again and good evening.
Thank you for listening to the German Historical Institute London podcast. Follow us on social media and check our website to keep up to date with new episodes.